Good evening. Good evening. My name is Max Wayland, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. On behalf of the Clark Forum, the Women's Center, and the Office of Institutional and Diversity Initiatives, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, Untying the Knot. From the fierce media battles over Proposition 8 to the constitutional amendment to prohibit gay marriage that recently passed the Iowa House, the issue of same-sex marriage is constantly in the public eye. At the same time, the face of traditional marriage is changing rapidly, with climbing divorce rates casting doubt on the institution as a whole. Amidst all of this, it is worthwhile to consider the institution of marriage and its relationship to the state, the subject of tonight's program. Our speaker tonight is Tamara Metz, an assistant professor of political science at Reed College. She's a political theorist with wide-ranging academic interest who graduated with honors from Brandeis University and got a PhD from Harvard. She's written extensively on marriage, and her work has been published in various journals, not to mention her recent book on the issue, Untying the Knot, Marriage, the State, and the Case for Their Divorce, which has been called essential reading as well as one of the best books on political theory in a long time by reviewers. At this time, please turn off all your cell phones and other electronic devices. A question and answer session will follow the lecture, so please hold your questions until then. And now please join me in welcoming Tamara Metz.
Thank you. So I mentioned to a few of you today that I gave myself the gift once I finished my book of not reading reviews. So it's nice that I'm only getting the positive reviews reported to me. So, thank you very much for inviting me to speak to you tonight. I'd especially like to thank the Clark Forum and the Department of Political Science for this opportunity. So tonight, I'm going to talk to you about the troubled relationship between marriage and the state. More precisely, I'm going to argue that the state should get out of the marriage business. I think that we should disestablish marriage, that the state should stop defining and conferring marital status, that it shouldn't use marriage as a category for dispersing benefits and assigning legal obligations. As a legal category, marriage should be abolished. But as a cultural status, marriage should be left to voluntary associations, to whichever religious, cultural, or social community is significant to those who wish to assume the status. And in place of marriage, the state should create a mechanism for protecting what I call intimate care that actually does square with our basic political commitments to liberty and equality. Now, if that all sounds a bit abstract to you, I have an excuse. I'm a political theorist, which means that the argument that I'm making, though it starts and ends in contemporary debates, political debates, backs up or moves beyond to our basic shared political commitments or principles. Now, I'm sure some of you are asking yourselves, what shared political principles can she possibly be talking about? Has she not been watching the news lately? And it's true. We Americans don't seem to agree on much when it comes to politics and our shared lives. All you have to do is turn on the news. And yet, I would point to a very contentious election, right, Gore v. Bush in 2000, to illustrate the fact that we Americans do share some pretty fundamental values when it comes to our common political lives. For instance, we are committed to working out our differences through established procedures, not through violence. We're committed to a constitutional framework, one in which a foundational document traces the basic outlines of our shared values or overlapping consensus, as I explained to one of the student groups that I spoke to today, right? Which is what John Rawls, the late great liberal political philosopher, called it. So I take it as relatively uncontroversial that we, as a political community in the United States, are committed to the sometimes conflicting, always contested values of liberty, equality, and supporting, or at least protecting, the essential labor of care that often, but not always, gets done in families. So let's call these liberal democratic values. Now, one thing that political theorists do is that we take a critical look at what we, as a political community, say and do. And we, that is political theorists, ask, what is really going on here? Are we saying one thing and doing another? Or do our practices reflect unstated assumptions that upon reflection we might reject? In any case, once we, that is political theorists, are clear about what's really going on, then we can use the principles that I just referred to, however abstract, however contested and changing, to test or assess our practices. Do they square with our principles? And if not, how might they? So I'm going to do a little bit of both of these tonight. All right, enough of the preamble. On to contemporary issues. The theoretical argument I'm making starts and ends in a critical assessment of what is really going on or under or behind debates and practices concerning marriage in the U.S. So, let's start where probably most of you are thinking when you think about marriage in contemporary debates these days, which is the same-sex marriage debate. So there are advocates, like San Francisco's former mayor, Gavin Newsom, and he's now something else in the Lieutenant Governor. I knew he'd moved up in the world. Right. He sees legalization of same-sex marriage as a matter of justice and a boon to the institution of marriage. On June 17, 2008, as he presided over the first such marriage recognized by the state of California, Newsom declared, "Today, marriage has been strengthened." Now, opponents, such as the supporters of California's Proposition 8, see legalizing same-sex marriage as a threat to a millennia-old institution. So as the Prop 8 ballot argument stated, quote, "Proposition 8 is simple and straightforward. Proposition 8 is about preserving marriage. It is not an attack on the gay lifestyle. It protects our children from being taught in schools that same-sex marriage is the same as traditional marriage." That is, it protects, keeps children from being taught that. "While gays have the right to their private lives, they do not have the right to redefine marriage as for everyone else." Now, Newsom and the Prop 8 supporters obviously disagree about a lot. And yet, for all of their disagreement, they share one crucial, and I'm going to argue very problematic, assumption, which is that the state should be in the business of defining and controlling marriage. Fights rage over who ought to have access to this status, but rarely do the parties in these debates defend the very foundation of their position. So tonight, I'm going to challenge the widely held and typically undefended assumption that the state should create, control, and rely upon marriage. Prudence and liberal commitments to liberty, equality, and families weigh heavily, I'm going to argue, against this arrangement. And I make a second closely related argument that the same principles recommend that the state should, however, recognize and support associations of intimate care, or for ease, and you can ask in the question and answer period about this, but for ease, let's just call them families. Associations of intimate care are families of all different sorts. Okay, so the first argument I'll make tonight is that our political values recommend that we disestablish marriage. To make this case, I need to first say a bit more about what I mean by the establishment of marriage. And how many here are familiar with constitutional law? So does the establishment of religion, or ring bells, disestablishment, non-establishment of religion? Okay. I hope it does. All right, so I need to say a little bit more about what I mean by the establishment of marriage. And this is a label that I use to describe what is really going on with respect to marriage in the U.S. So using the language of church-state relations, that is, this establishment language, which I intend to highlight three features of the current arrangement. So first, this is the first feature, in contrast to the state's official non-involvement in non-established religion, right, that's the official relationship between the church and the state in the U.S., government in the U.S. is heavily involved in marriage. The state defines marriage, and in fact, it jealously guards this prerogative. All you have to do is ask the Mormon polygamist Tom Green, who got a 5-year jail sentence, even though he never asked, and in fact, he studiously avoided letting the state know that he was involved in plural marriages. The state establishes its preferred version of marriage by providing exclusive material, legal, and expressive benefits to those who may opt for the status, and by punishing those who violate its norms. So the benefits, by now, any of you who've paid any attention to the same-sex marriage debates, you've heard about the benefits. Punishments for nonconformity may seem less obvious, but current and historical examples abound. Criminalization and prosecution of polygamous marriage and interracial marriage before 1967, the non-recognition of marriage between slaves and free people, and, of course, between individuals of the same sex are some examples. Okay, second, the second feature that I'm trying to highlight by calling marriage established in the U.S. As with religion, citizens hold deeply divergent views of what marriage is and how intimate life ought to be arranged. So debates concerning same-sex marriage, high divorce rates, divergent views about infidelity, polygamy, and the proper roles of husband and wife, these all evince profound disagreements about what marriage is. Flourishing diversity of family forms highlight the lack of consensus regarding intimate family, intimate caregiving life generally. And I'm sorry, I just realized I do not have a watch or a clock. I have no idea. I'm just going to keep talking to you all night. So, thank you, Vanessa. Thank you. All right. So, in this context, to define and rely upon marriage is to privilege one version of the institution over all others. And crucially, and this is crucial, over all other sorts of intimate caregiving arrangements or families. Okay. And third, the language of establishment draws attention to another crucial similarity between marriage and religion. Marriage is a very special social institution, much more like religion than, say, civil union, in terms of its distinguishing social psychological aims or functions, and in terms of what it asks or assumes about the communal authority that controls it. These features of marriage mean that when the state defines and confers marital status, our liberal democratic state is playing a role that it ought not to play. Okay, so let me explain by asking the rhetorical question, what makes marital status different from, say, civil union status, right? As the reservation of the label suggests, and I have to say, if anyone has any interest in constitutional law or reading court cases, I highly recommend that you read the court cases of the last, 10 years, the same-sex marriage debate cases. They're very, very interesting, in part because it's clear that they've got this thing that they can't quite work out. They don't quite want to say, I think it's all about this meaning issue. And it's fun to kind of read through them and see how the justices from different jurisdictions but are all taking a sort of a different tack to get around this problem. So let's see. So by reserving the difference between civil union and marriage, or the registered domestic partnership law in California is even a better example, because that law gave same-sex couples essentially every single legal benefit that came with marital status except the label, right? So that suggests that the difference comes down to meaning. Not very, you know, that's pretty obvious. But it's not just any meaning. It's the very kind of meaning, I am going to argue, that the framers of the federal and many state constitutions that led them to insist in the early years of our republic that church and state be separated by non-establishment clauses. As an institution, and especially in terms of what it asks and assumes about the public authority that defines and controls it, marriage is more like a bar mitzvah or a confirmation than it is like a registered domestic partnership. So here's what I have in mind. Unlike a registered domestic partnership, marriage demands and elicits what I call ethical authority, the moral and not merely the legal or instrumental approval of the recognizing community. The aim of this recognition is to alter the deepest aspects of self-understanding. So here you might think of what many understand to be happening when a couple stands in front of its community, and whether that's the community is the Catholic Church or, you know, a group of hippies in the Redwoods in Northern California, and they accept the marital status bestowed by the community that's there giving, you know, saying, yes, you're married. The community's conferral and the couple's acceptance are understood as acts intended to alter the way that each sees and relates to each other. Now, compare this to when the state doles out a driver's license or a small business license. Right? Sure, there's some meaning attached, of course, but we'd be hard-pressed to call it ethical recognition. Now, here's the dig. This special quality of marriage assumes that the conferring authority represents and defends a comprehensive story about the relationship between the individual in the couple and the couple in the community. And again, the examples of the bar mitzvah or baptismal status are illuminating. Those statuses are conferred with the aim of altering the beliefs to integrate the individuals into the norms and values that define that community. By calling on the ethical authority of a community of shared worldviews, these statuses alter, they change, they create self-understandings. Now, if I'm right that marriage is fundamentally different from civil union because of its power to transform beliefs and especially self-understanding, then when the state acts as a controlling public authority in defining and limiting access to the status, it assumes the role of ethical authority, a role that for good reasons we liberal Democrats ought to be very wary of, or of which we liberal Democrats ought to be very wary. Now, you can see why it is especially appropriate to speak of marriage as established, right? Just as the establishment of religion refers to the state's involvement in defining, inculcating, and reproducing a particular religious worldview, so the establishment of marriage highlights the state's integral role in reproducing and relying on belief in a particular institutional form of intimate life and its ties to a community. So, the first reason that marriage should be disestablished is to protect liberty. I always feel like John Revere. Is that John Revere? You get that right? Yeah. Paul Revere. John Revere, Paul Revere, right. My early American histories. right, so the first reason that marriage should be disestablished is to protect liberty. Very broadly speaking, disestablishing marriage would bolster a protected realm of conscience and belief. As I've argued, the role of the public authority in marriage is not merely incidental. It is integral to the potential of marriage. As the primary public authority in marriage, the state engages in a role the basic purpose of which, I've already argued, is to alter self-understandings. In so doing, the state actively intrudes on the realm of belief. And thus, it violates one of the basic liberal mechanisms for protecting liberty. So that's very broad. But on a concrete level, releasing marriage from the hands of government would protect a unique kind of expression. Unlike under the current regime, where citizens can actually be prosecuted for unsanctioned use of the marital title, as I mentioned, this Tom Green from Utah was. Under the proposed regime, that is, having marriage disestablished, citizens who wish to call themselves married could do so without fear of state punishment. And as with baptismal status, non-governmental authorities could confer the label, let's just call this freedom of marital expression. Okay, doesn't seem very important, but I have a long argument about why it's really important. We can talk about that in the Q&A. Disestablishing marriage would guard freedom in another way, however. It would protect particularly vulnerable individuals from unnecessary state coercion, exclusion, and undue punishment. So just as the non-establishment of religion ensures that a citizen's right to vote cannot depend on their religious affiliation, so too the disestablishment of marriage would guarantee that government-provided benefits for families or intimate caregiving would not hinge on an individual's public acceptance of a particular vision of marriage. Martha Feynman has persuasively shown that the state uses marital status as the primary avenue through which to support caregiving. And when it does, it significantly disadvantages many actual caregivers. Social welfare policies aimed at discouraging unwed single motherhood are powerful examples of this dynamic. By disentangling marriage from state support of families or intimate care, the state would no longer unduly burden caregivers who chose not to clothe their relationships in the thick normative dressing of marriage. Freedom of association would also benefit under the regime that I propose. In the American constitutional tradition, marriage has long served to justify this protection, that is, of intimate association. And yet, as Drusilla Cornell argues, the marital origins of this protection obscure the wider ethical and political importance of a protected domain of intimate association. So doing away with the marital category would be one crucial step in dislodging marriage from its seat as the reigning proxy for relationships that need and deserve protection. The move would help highlight the fact that all human beings, married or not, heterosexual or not, single, paired, sexual, celibate, all of us need a space within which to imagine and enact our sexuate lives. So, the second reason to disestablish marriage is to support marriage, and by extension, all families who depend on its special powers for support. So, the liberal state is a legal, not an ethical authority. And when it functions as the public authority of greatest significance vis-a-vis marriage, the state actually threatens marriage by undermining the force of its constitutive sway. Again, you'll forgive me, but the bar mitzvah example is helpful. We would doubt, would we not, both the effectiveness of the status and the justice of the action were the state to start defining and setting standards for and regulating access to bar mitzvah status. To affect its psychological or psychosocial transformation, the status must come from the community of shared religious believers and from Jewish religious leaders as representatives of that community of belief that gives the status meaning. For the state to try to fill its role would rightly seem inappropriate and surely be ineffective, right? You can just imagine going to like the, you know, Bureau of Bar Mitzvah Status. So, you say, disestablishing marriage might well
bolster the meaning side of the institution and protect various kinds of freedom of expression and association. But what about children, property, fairness, equality, and especially just all of these concerns with what you might call the material side of marriage, and the legitimate public welfare concerns that the state currently addresses through marriage? Do liberal commitments to liberty outweigh those to fairness and equality?
No.
No, absolutely not. And any account of marriage in the state that ignores the historical connections between marriage or among marriage, intimate caregiving, and inequality, especially gender, sexual, and familial, would be totally inadequate. But the good thing is that leaving marriage to civil society is no different from leaving the control of baptismal status to the church. In neither case do we assume that the state thereby withdraws from its role in protecting the vulnerable and promoting equality. What we do assume is that the best way to balance liberty and equality and fairness in a diverse society is for the state to be concerned primarily with regulating action, not expression or thought, and then only to the extent necessary to protect other citizens from harm or to guarantee a reasonably fair distribution of the benefits and burdens of social cooperation. Government has a crucial role to play in all of these arenas, and our commitments to freedom and equality and families and the work they do demand that the state play an active role in recognizing and supporting intimate caregiving units or families. Why? Well, the short answer is that care, this intimate care that I've kept referring to, is both necessary and risky. What do I mean? What do I mean to say that intimate care is both necessary and risky? Let me have some water and I will tell you. First, a fact. Human beings are deeply and entirely interdependent, right? Not a single one of us could survive, much less thrive, without the care, the physical, emotional, and social attention of another person. In other words, care, and especially intimate care, the sort that is paradigmatically exchanged in families, is necessary, right? That seems pretty uncontroversial to me, though it's often been ignored, at least in the canon of Western political thought and often in our laws. So it's not only necessary for individuals, but it's also necessary for society in the following sense. If your parents had not taken care of you, you would not be sitting there, and I would not have an audience member, right? So there's a way in which, and you guys wouldn't have another participant in this audience. So there's a way in which we are all, whoever it was who gave this young woman care, a certain, not just a debt of gratitude, but, you know, if I were an economist, I don't know what the right word is, but we'd owe them something, right? Now the second feature about care is that intimate care, especially, while it's uniquely consonant with human attachment, particularity, diversity, and freedom, it is risky. It's especially risky for the person who is giving care or the people who give care. Why is this? I was describing this to a group of students today. I mean, you have to think of it in terms of each human being has a sort of limited amount of resources. I can spend all those resources on me, or I can spend some of those resources on somebody else, right? And if there are other human beings in the world who need care and can't take care of themselves, in the obvious example of children, if I'm going to do that, let's say I have this many resources, right? And I have to spend this much in order to take care of this other person. Well, what happens here, this reduction in the resources I have to take care of myself makes me vulnerable, right? Because I now have less resources to take care of myself. And Martha Feynman, who's a legal theorist and who also writes about marriage, calls that derivative dependency or derivative vulnerability. So in other words, you may be vulnerable, but if I'm taking care of you, I also then become vulnerable. So giving care is risky because if, as I'm depleting my resources, I put myself at greater risk of not being able to take care of myself. Now, so because of the risks involved in intimate care generates systematic vulnerabilities and therefore a disincentive to do caregiving, all societies, and any society that wants to ensure that care gets done and it, that its benefits and burdens are done distributed fairly, has to create some sort of social insurance against those risks. And every society has some system. The system that we're most familiar with in this society, that is to say 21st century U.S., has something to do often with marriage, right? Often the social insurance is the institution of marriage. But I've just argued that the arrangement that marriage, state involvement in marriage, conflicts with our commitment to liberty and equality and even the health of marriage. So what is to be done? Now, my answer to this is something I call an intimate caregiving union status. It's an ICGU, otherwise known as ICGU. It's a terrible label. I'm asking anyone for good suggestions. I got a great one today, which is combining my interest in care with my interest in marriage, and you can call it carriage. Somehow it's, I don't know. So I'm still looking. That may be what I'm going to go through. For the rest of the evening, I'll call it an ICGU, but please feel free to let me know if you have good ideas. So I think that an ICGU status would best balance these demands. And it would do so by limiting the object and the intent of state action to the material and the instrumental. So, in many ways, an ICGU status would look a lot like the legal status of marriage today. It would afford legal recognition from which would flow various legal presumptions about kinship, protections from certain types of intrusion, and material benefits like taxes. As with marital status now, an ICGU status would be defined, conferred, and if necessary, dissolved by the state. But unlike marriage, ICGU would be expressly tailored to protecting intimate care in its various forms. So, for example, the status would reflect assumptions of longevity and resource sharing. Also, to protect the norms of unmonitored reciprocity and to protect caregivers, at dissolution, property would be divided to achieve substantive post-dissolution equality. Crucially, and this is very important, ICGU would be designed with instrumental, not constitutive purposes in mind. Any special expressive significance that was attached to ICGU would be incidental, as opposed to the intentionally mind-altering significance of marital status. Disestablishing marriage and creating an ICGU status would better serve equality, fairness, and care than do legal regimes currently in place in most liberal democracies. First, this change would shift the focus of public discussion from the interminable disagreement about the definition of marriage to questions about the importance, nature, and distribution of intimate care. Exposing the real costs and benefits of caregiving would increase the chances that they would be distributed fairly and that actual caregivers would be supported adequately. Defining caregiving would undoubtedly provoke controversy, but controversy is inevitable and is far better than obfuscating silence. In addition, a civil status expressly tailored to protecting intimate care would be more appropriately crafted and accurate in its target. Therefore, it would be more effective than marriage as a tool for realizing legitimate public welfare goals of supporting intimate care, broadly defined. Okay, second, the proposed changes would make it easier for the state to simultaneously meet its legitimate public welfare concerns and realize the aspiration to treat citizens equally. By replacing the imprecise and distracting prism of marriage as the primary means for supporting intimate care with a narrowly focused instrumental status, That would increase the chances that all actual caregivers would be served equally by the law. Such a status would be less likely to exclude and punish actual caregivers, and therefore actual caregiving would be better served. Third, and finally, the proposed changes would benefit gender equality. By bringing the reality of caregiving to the fore of public discussion, disestablishing marriage would shine light on the derivative vulnerabilities and gender inequalities that are often created by current intimate caregiving arrangements. No longer hidden behind the veil of marriage, questions of how the unpaid elements of intimate caregiving are distributed, at what costs and benefits, and to whom would move inexorably to the center of public discourse, and thus increase the chances that the cost and benefits would be distributed fairly. Okay, back to contemporary debates. So how does this relate to the current debates? Well, first let me say something that I hope is clear, but as I said to students today, I've had a dissertation advisor who introduced me three times as the woman who wanted to abolish marriage. I do not want to abolish marriage. I think marriage is great. I think it can be very powerful. I just don't think that the state should be involved in it. Now, that said, the argument I've made is quite obviously a critique of both the pro-same-sex marriage and the anti-same-sex marriage position, because both assume without defense that marriage should be established. So the anti-same-sex marriage essentially holds the following. A, that marriage is what we say it is. B, that it is a lifelong-ish union between a man and a woman. And C, something that it is something that the state appropriately defines, controls, etc. So most critics of this position, for what I happen to think are very good reasons, reject A and or B. So my argument tonight focuses on the problems with C. The basic thought here is that in a diverse liberal polity like ours, we will never agree on A or B, but that is okay as long as we reject C. That is, as long as we reject the assumption that marriage must be controlled and defined by the state. Let marriage, I say, like religion, be a private affair. For the most part, this strategy has served us quite well with religion. We seem to do okay even though we don't agree who gets to tell us who God is or whether she even exists. So that's equivalent to A, or what God is, and that's B. Okay, now I'm starting again. As long as we reject the assumption C, that the state needs to be involved, religion seems to flourish just fine without government. On the other hand, my argument is also a critique of the pro-same-sex marriage camp. For it assumes, again, without defense, and I hope I have convinced you without good reason, that marriage is something that the state must confer and control. Same-sex marriage, different-sex marriage, multiple-sex marriage, my read of our liberal democratic commitments is that the state ought not to be in the business of any sex marriage. Now, I've argued elsewhere that as long as the state does dole out marriage licenses, our commitment to equal treatment before the law demands that it make those licenses available to same-sex couples. Others have spent more energy articulating the reasons for this. I'm happy to explain my position. Do I think these arguments are likely to get much attention in circles that really matter for making things happen? I spoke to two policy courses today. On the one hand, no. Neither side, and I promise you I've had conversations with people on both sides, neither side is particularly interested in having their incoherence of their positions pointed out to them, and certainly not pointed out that they share an incoherence. And yet, I have to say that over the last 15 years, as the same-sex marriage cases have been working themselves through the courts, as advocates on both sides, jurists on the bench, and scholars in our ivory tower have been thinking through the issue, that lingering incoherence is getting harder to hide. It's forcing its way up in flints and stints into the common ponderings. And I would point in this instance to first the 2003 case in Massachusetts, where the court handed down its landmark Goodridge decision, where the dissenting Justice Sussman jokingly suggested that the state should stop using the M word altogether. She had no intention of being taken seriously, and she wasn't, except by me. But 4 years later, another landmark case, this time in California, in remarriages, the majority opinion, it's fascinating, I'm telling you, it is good reading, not just because I'm interested in this stuff. It is full of instances where the basic question of why the state is involved in the marriage business at all is actually taken up with some seriousness. Now, I've argued in various places that they take it up, but they never follow it through to its logical conclusion. And my sense, though, is that this logic is getting harder to ignore. So that's the end of my talk. I look forward to your questions.
Raise your hand and wait for the mic to reach you before posing your question.
And I'm happy to take very skeptical, even hostile questions. We can... Excellent.
I was just wondering if you could explain more on the ICP test you're talking about. Because I was just thinking, if you seem to argue that anyone would be able to get that, like, is that a two-person thing? Is that what exactly does it entail? Who is it with?
Mm-hmm. Yes, great question. So somebody in one of the classes today asked me, well, what if like a group of friends wanted to, assume this status? And and the short version of my answer is, sure, if they want to assume the status, they want to assume the benefits and the burdens of the status, it's fine with me. I mean, I think that our political principles demand that, I don't care. I think our political principles say to us, we don't care if they're sleeping together, right? We don't care if they want to have children or not. That's not something that we as a polity really need to be concerned about. I think what we do need to be concerned about is we need to be sure that intimate care is happening and that its benefits and burdens are being distributed in some degree fairly, in a way so that it does happen. And if these folks, a group of friends, want to commit to the burdens. Now, the burdens would involve, for instance, let's say you four friends wanted to shack up and get an ICGU, and if one of them decided to split, I can imagine that they would then have to split whatever property they had, acquired as a group in the time that they were together four ways. So that's a burden. That's a kind of a pain, right? I mean, it means that you're not just kind of willy-nilly going to go get an ICGU status. So I say as long as they are willing to accept the burdens. And, I should also back up and say, I'm not actually a policy analyst. I'm a political theorist, which just means I'm like one step back. I get to kind of imagine things, and then hopefully somebody in the room becomes a policy person and they figure out a way to actually try this out and see if it works. So I get to be like, well, try that, see, this is why I think that might work, and this is the logic behind it. And the logic to me is what we ought to be concerned with is care. And the debate, by the way, what exactly would count as an ICGU? I have an opinion. And I, you know, I kind of sketch it out in my book. But we live in a liberal democracy, and I'm totally committed to it. And so I think, in fact, what we would need to have a debate about it. And as I said, you know, briefly in the talk, I think that debate would be very fierce. But I think it would be less fierce and less, you know, stuck than the current debate, say, around same-sex marriage. Although I actually think that that debate is moving. I mean, I think I predict, and this is just, you know, I'm sure that same-sex marriage will eventually become, you know, legal and not the too distant future. I cannot imagine how it won't. But what do I know? So does that answer your question? Okay, great. Yeah.
I was just wondering, with you wanting to abolish all legal relations with marriage, what would you do about age and someone that's too young according to the laws now? And if the Catholic Church would just be in charge of marriage as we see it religiously now, they don't have laws established for age or incest or things like that. So how would you define those if we're not going to use the legal system?
Yeah, that's a great question. So my answer to that is roughly that I think it's within the bounds, because it concerns the physical well-being of vulnerable people, I think it's totally within the bounds of a liberal democratic state to outlaw sex between, you know, majors and minors. I think that's... and so whether it's happening in what someone calls a marriage or someone calls a carriage or whatever, or it outside everything, I think it should be that the state should be involved in being sure that it should be illegal, basically, right? Wherever it's happening. So if the Catholic Church started saying, if the Catholic Church started saying, you know, we think that it's okay, not in my view in this polity. I think we have good arguments, and in fact, we do outlaw religious practices that violate what we consider, you know, beyond the bounds of acceptable within a liberal democratic polity. So, I think that it shouldn't happen in marriage, it shouldn't happen out of marriage, it shouldn't happen in carriages, it shouldn't happen. And I think we have good liberal democratic reasons for it not happening, and that would stand whether it was in a marriage or not. So does that answer your question? Are you convinced?
I'm specifically talking about necessarily sex within a marriage, just someone consenting way too young, like at age 12.
Yeah. Yeah, so it raises the question, we know that there are Mormon fundamentalists who, you know, polygamist sex, where that happens. And my view is they can say whatever they want as long as he is not sleeping with she. Or, you know, if she's the older one, she's not sleeping with him. I mean, I think that the distinction between action and thought, to me, is really important. And I know there are lots of problems with it, but in this case, I think if that's what they want to say, we live in a deeply diverse world, and I'm willing to let them, you know, I'm willing to say, okay, you can say whatever you want when it comes to whether you're actually, you know, physically harming a child, it's not okay. And I realize they're... so that's the answer. Yeah.
Hi. So this sounds to me a whole lot like Judith Butler's argument in Undoing Gender that she made a few years ago about how basically basing off the French system in which you pick a person to sort of be your inheritor, to make medical decisions about you, to sort of be your person, right?
Yeah.
So whether it's your romantic partner, your best friend, family member. And what, of course, is important there is the idea that the a lot of the care you're talking about and these communities of care is done by the state. So, you know, care for the elderly, daycare, medical care, et cetera, et cetera. So what I'm trying to figure out is your argument a particularly American phenomenon? Is it because we have such a bastardized, incompetent version of government in which we provide very little care for people that this system is so necessary?
That's a good question. Yeah. I can see, in fact, I was just saying to Andy on the way over here that, I think it is probably a very American argument, though I think it sort of has legs, like it can walk into other liberal democratic polities, but I think kind of culturally and historically speaking it is. And it's funny, I have sort of mixed feelings. I mean, it's funny for Butler to be happy about such heavy state involvement. I mean, because she, of all people, appreciates the kind of disciplining that goes whenever with state power in a way that I think outstrips when it's happening in non. When it's not happening, when it's not being taken care of by the state. So basically, I think when the state is in charge of doing things, that's like, the state is a massive, look, power is everywhere. You know, I believe that. But the state, there's a special centralization and kind of character of power in and from the state. And so the wanting the state to be the provider of care.
But she doesn't argue that.
Oh, so what, I thought that's what
she,
you...
I said that because she was talking about the French system, but she, as far as I can tell, what you're arguing and she's arguing are identical.
Oh.
So in terms of having, you know, this what you're calling families, she's referring to, what is it called, the PACs or the PALs, whatever it was,
the
French system where
you
identify one other person. So I don't think she's arguing that, but she's taking it from France, which is a French example, so, you know, what the French government provides is obviously very different from what the American government provides. So I'm asking you if you see a difference in, I mean, she obviously wants to do something very different. She wants revolution before we have all this crap, right? So it seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, that you're not arguing that you're arguing for something very different and just saying, keep things as they are, except this one thing different.
Well, I'd like a revolution also.
Okay.
But the difference between Butler and I is that she's I mean, really, the difference is basically probably different strategic inclinations. I mean, I think actually we do. So, I mean, I'd love a revolution, but I'm also very. And I'm not even that. I mean, look at, like, nobody really takes this proposal seriously except a bunch of students and academics. Like, everyone else is like, you're crazy, you know. So, but people think I'm slightly less crazy than Butler, so maybe someone will listen to it. I don't know. But, I mean, she's a lot smarter and sexier, so they'll probably, you know. I don't know. Okay. Yeah. It's true.
Do you see marriage, the idea of marriage, and the ICGU coexisting?
Yeah.
A little blurry on.
Yes.
And I didn't understand from her. A little blurry on how those two things would exist together and who would go which way.
Okay, the same way that bar mitzvah status coexists with driver's license status. I mean, exactly, right? I know, I'm sorry, it's like, once I get, I mean, whatever, baptismal status coexists with voting status, like, yeah, I mean, it's that simple, basically. Is that clear?
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah, come by.
Marriage is, in our society, so much greater than a bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
It's so much greater than a bar mitzvah.
Totally.
I'm just thinking about how those two things could come.
Right. So in this way, it is a lot more. I mean, I'm sort of being flip when I say it's like, you know, baptismal status and voting status or something. But precisely because, for the reason that you give, that marriage as a social cultural institution in our world is a lot more significant, has a lot more kind of moving power than baptism or, you know, bar mitzvah. And I think there's some positive things about it. I think that as I've said, there are good reasons that we should get, you know, let marriage be taken care of by various communities, religious, non-religious, whatever, but not the state.
Hi. In your opinion, what is the relationship between marriage and capitalism in terms of...
Well, have you read Engels on marriage and the family and... Yeah? All right, so that's the first thing I'm going to do is tell you to go find that he's got this piece on... And it's not Marx, it's Engels on... marriage or the family. I forget exactly. Does anyone know exactly what it is? It's either marriage or the family. Anyway, I mean, the answer is there. Like, that's one answer. But could you be a little bit more specific? Because
sure, in terms of like creating people for the labor force and then having anything else, like any other unions be deviant from that in terms of contributing to society.
Yeah. Right. So this is kind of a cultural historical question, I think. In other words, what role has marriage in fact played in producing consumers and producers in a capitalist world? Would that be a good restatement of the question? So I think it's played a huge role in it, way huger than I'm equipped to kind of give you a good answer to, but I can tell you two good places to go look for good answers. One is Nancy Cott's book. It's called Public Vows. She's an historian, and she's written about the relationship about marriage. It's a great book. And then I think the Engels piece, those are probably good places to start. I mean, I think the answer is that there is a relationship and it has played, but I'm not really equipped to go into the details of it. Hi.
Visualizing what an ICGU would look like. I guess what's confusing about the definition of marriage now with the state is how you conflate the secular economic aspect of marriage with the somewhat narrow moralistic side that has more to do with religion. What are the, besides like the division of property after marriage dissolves, what are some of the other economic benefits that happen with marriage,
mm-hmm.
So I can better visualize what an ICU would look like and how
it might expand. Yeah. Okay. I used to be, when I first was writing this, I called it an ICU, and my editor said, that would be a very bad idea. Okay. All right, so one example, I mean, one way to think about this, if you are paying much attention to the same-sex marriage debates, advocates for same-sex marriage often list
quite appropriately, a long list of legal benefits that go with marriage. And I know about these intimate. My sister is very active in the same-sex marriage, advocating for same-sex marriage, and she's also a lawyer. And so, actually, I was home recently, and she was giving me a practice for a lecture that she was giving on this subject. So it's like this long, 1,114 benefits that you don't get, federal benefits that you don't get if you are not, if your marriage isn't recognized legally. So that would be one place to go. I mean, just go look at that list, and that can kind of give you a sense of some of the things that would probably be included in an ICGU. But an example would be a presumption of kinship. So I'm sure you've heard, like, one of the problems with not being able to get married is you God forbid, you're in a car accident, or your partner is in a car accident, they go to the hospital, and you are not presumed to be their decision maker, right? I mean, one of the things that when you're married, you are the next of kin. If you aren't married in this country, you are not presumed to be the next of kin, so you don't get to make the decisions, the medical decisions, right? So an ICGU would, and this is one of the burdens, I mean, it's a benefit, but it's also a burden, right? That if you assumed ICGU status, your kinship relationship would be presumed. Now, for those of us who can get married, we don't even really think about it. But it matters, right? When it comes down to it, that's the kind of thing that matters. So that's an example. And then there's, of course, tax benefits. My sister is also a tax attorney. And you cannot believe how much business she's getting because the craziness of, like, if you happen to be one of those people in California, that a same-sex couple that got married in this small period, and your relationship is recognized as marriage by, California, but it's not recognized by the federal government, like, the tax implications are insane. I mean, they're really messy. So that would be another example that an ICGU would help, yeah. Anyone? Excellent. Over there.
This will be our last question.
Okay. So I like your idea that you have going with addressing C, that it's C points.
Mm-hmm.
So that's nice and all, but I think if you're going to be looking for a revolution, you've got to do it right. You've got to address A and B. It's not marriage. I like the ICGU,
yeah.
But I don't think that it shouldn't be separate, because I think if you make them separate, you're just further ostracizing same-sex couples.
Yeah, so this is... I am deeply moved by that position, because I believe, and I have argued, it's basically beyond me how it can continue to be the case that same-sex marriage is not. I mean, I understand why politically. And I understand the Democratic argument. But at the end of the day, it doesn't hold. I mean, it's not convincing to me historically or philosophically or da-da-da. So on the one hand, I'm totally in that camp. As long as the state is giving out licenses, it should be giving them out to same-sex couples. And I'm a political philosopher. And as I've made really clear, like, my first commitment, actually, this is, I guess, is ultimately I can't believe I'm saying this, but it's ultimately to a kind of philosophical kind of consistency or clarity. I mean, I think ultimately that the argument for getting disestablishing marriage is just really philosophically powerful. And so what I do, I send lots of money. I mean, I support my sister aggressively. And I don't ever get, I never ask her to hawk my book to her friends or her enemies, you know. So I support it, but ultimately, at the end of the day, I think that my argument still stands and it's useful. I mean, I was telling one of the students today, she said, one of the students asked, well, if your idea is such a good idea, why does nobody believe it, right? That's totally a great question. And I said, well, the thing is that what I do as a scholar, my job as a scholar and what I'm sort of dedicated to as a scholar is looking around at our practices and what we say about things and trying to figure out, like, are there hidden assumptions under those practices that conflict with what we say we're committed to? And if they do, it's funny, I just gave a lecture on Plato and Socrates. And, you know, Socrates calls himself a gadfly in, I think it's the Apology or the Crito, one of those two. This is like, I feel a little bit like the gadfly. Like, what I do is I say, look, guys, here are your principles. Here's what you're doing and saying. They conflict. And I think we are rational. This is like the optimistic me. I think that as human beings, we actually care about those things. We care when our practices conflict with our principles. So, you know, I think I'm going to, you know, I'll fund the revolutionaries and I'll do my own revolutionary work over here. And I think at the end of the day, they will converge. That's my fantasy, but I could be wrong. And really, you know, I'm a two-bit academic. Ain't no one going to listen to me. So hope that answers your question satisfactorily.
Please join me in thanking Tara Mamet one more time.